All right, so this is Bio 241, Human Physiology, and it is September 24th. And I got let's talk about some news. I changed my office hours. Not many people stop by my office hours, but some people do every once in a while. They're from 12:30 to 1:30, instead of from 12 to 1, Monday, Wednesday. Same room, so I just switched them back a half hour. It's like after class, I usually can't get up there right away, because I'm talking to students and stuff like that. So I changed those around. And the second thing is, let's talk about the test coming up. So the material on the test, is it scheduled for next time? I forget. But anyway, let's talk about when it really will be. It's going to be chapters 6, chapters 4, and 5. So that's the same as chapters 4, 5, and 6. Okay, so we're done with 6. We're almost done with 4, and we'll start chapter 5 today. And I suppose we might be able to finish 5 today, but that's probably a little over-optimistic. So let's have the test on Wednesday of next week so we can finish up some details on Monday. But that means you're going to be really busy this weekend studying for the test. Even though we didn't cover everything, this weekend would be the time to put in a lot of time to learn as much as you can about chapter number 5. Okay? And you know what? Chapter number 5 is not going to sink in overnight. So you got to spend some time over the weekend on it. Yeah. Yeah, so instead of September 29th, it's going to be October 1st. All right? Does anybody have their calendar out and confirm that? October 1st. All right, but don't forget the chapters are going to be 4, 5, and 6. And all those figures that are on your study guide, you got to know. All right, so we were talking about enzymes last time, so let's review enzymes real quick. Yeah, shut up, you guys. So enzymes. What kind of compound is an enzyme? It's a protein. Most enzymes are proteins. So the basic building blocks are amino acids. They have a certain kind of conformation, right? The secondary structure is the building block for the primary structure is a building block for secondary structure, which is a building block for tertiary structure. So these enzymes have shapes, and because they have three-dimensional shapes, they have pits and grooves and fossas and depressions in them that can act as active sites for binding substrates. All right, so what the heck does an enzyme do? What does it do? Just a simple picture first. An enzyme does? Speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. And how does it do that? How is that accomplished? By lowering the activation energy. And I gave you a couple examples on the board. Your book has a pretty good example. Okay, say that again. I don't know, I thought somebody had a question. Okay, no question. So that's about enzymes. They speed up the rate of chemical reaction by decreasing the activation energy. You can denature a protein, any kind of protein, and if it's an enzyme, the enzymatic activity is going to go to zero, and you can't ever get it back again. You can't get a denatured protein back into its original conformation. There's only one exception to that rule that I'm aware of, and maybe I mentioned this when we were talking about biomolecules. Did anybody know how you can denature a protein and then get it back to the way it was? For instance, I was talking about curly hair. You can get a permanent in hair that's denaturing that protein that makes up your hair, but you can also reverse the permanent, right? That would be renaturing. That's the only example I've ever heard of being able to renature a protein once it has been denatured, either by putting curls in or taking curls out, for instance. Okay. So that's something about enzymes. They have specificity, they have competition, and saturation, just like transporter molecules, because of that active site. Substrates have to bind to the active site first. All right, so before products can form, what molecule has to form? Something special has to form before products can form in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. The enzyme-substrate complex. Yeah, that's an exam figure, so you got to make sure you can label that one. Don't forget about that. And when a protein is denatured, the active sites go away, so the enzyme-substrate complex cannot form, therefore products cannot form. as a result of that. What's the difference between an enzyme before and after the reaction that it catalyzes? Absolutely nothing, right? The enzyme can catalyze that reaction over and over again, thousands of times per second, as a matter of fact, for the lifetime of that particular enzyme. All right, then we talked about a couple other participants in enzyme-catalyzed reactions. One of these molecules sort of acts like a regulator of an enzyme. It can activate it or it can turn it off. You need to have a little bit of these other molecules to give, to just make sure that the enzyme has activity. What were those things? Cofactor. The little inorganic molecules are cofactors. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Am I going the wrong way? No. Going the right way. Cofactor. Come on, cofactor. Where's cofactor? Here's cofactor. All right, cofactor are inorganic metal ions, and they bind to the protein, and somehow the binding to the protein changes the active site, so it's more appropriate to accept the substrates. The second compound we talked about was a coenzyme. How would you want to think of a coenzyme? It's a large organic molecule, and typically you would think of a vitamin. All right, so that's sort of where we are right at the moment. Oh, wait, did we stop here?
No.
No, we're through that. All right, so what principle is this? It goes by two names. Law of mass action is number one, and number two is Le Chatelier's principle. And I should put that on the slide right here because I always forget how to spell it. I won't ask you how to spell it on the test, although spelling is always a good thing to ask on a practical exam, but I'm not going to give practical exams in here. Okay. Why is spelling so important in a practical exam? You could? Well, so you don't get it marked wrong, for sure, but because this is school, you should learn how to spell things correctly. All right, so this just says that if we have a reversible reaction, as you see with this double arrow right here, these intermediates can be interconverted into each other depending on their concentration. So if we take water away, if we take water out of the system, which way is this reaction going to go? To the left or to the right? It's going to go to the left to fill up this empty spot right here where we took away all these water molecules. Or if we put a bunch of water into the system, which way is it going to go? It's going to go to the right. We call that the law of mass action. Okay, there's one other law that you talked about in lab, and that is that the number of carbons that you have on one side of the equation has to match the number of carbons on the other side. As a matter of fact, all of the elements that you have on one side of a chemical reaction has to match up with the number of those exact same elements on the right-hand side. And that's just the conservation of matter. We can't create elements like we couldn't put like gold right over here just by mixing water and carbon dioxide with the right temperature. Right? That's what we would call alchemy. So we have to stay with the same elements and in the same proportion. All right, so we talked about metabolic pathways, all this kind of stuff, bioenergetics. There's a good slide that I want you to remember, and it's diagrammed by looking at some reactants going to products, and here's a plot, right? The vertical axis is free energy, the Gibbs free energy, right? Versus a couple different kinds of reactions. So here, reactants are gaining energy. They're gaining free energy. All right, that can't happen with just one system all by itself, right? Because this is what we call an endergonic reaction. Energy is being consumed. In order for an endergonic reaction to proceed, it has to get energy from some other reaction, right? And that other reaction has to be losing more energy compared to the endergonic reaction gaining in order for this to proceed. So you see the big wheel, this would be an exergonic set of reactions or one exergonic reaction. As it's proceeding, it can be coupled to an endergonic reaction to make it proceed in what? An unfavorable direction. So for instance, in terms of muscle, there's a chemical reaction, right, that does what? It allows the muscle to shorten, right? And I could put like a 200-pound weight in my hand right here and I could lift it up like that. Very unfavorable. Right, using all that ATP up, but All right, there has to be other reactions that do what? That even give off more energy than what the muscle is requiring to lift up. All right, and that is, we're going to look at that, that's cellular respiration. Okay, so the muscle is endergonic, and cellular respiration is exergonic, that's making the ATP so that I can lift that muscle, lift that weight up. Here's that ATP molecule. You saw where the high energy phosphates are. And this is, I think, where we left off last time, oxidation reduction reactions. And a lot of metabolism, there are oxidation reduction reactions. All right, so you just got to, even if you, when you sit down and take the test, even if you have to write the definition of these things down and think about it so you don't get confused, that's fine with me. Okay, just remember, when a molecule gains an electron, it becomes reduced. And when a molecule loses an electron, it becomes oxidized. And I wrote on the board what Leo Gurr or oil rig are just little funny little sayings that you could have to remember this rule right here. So a reducing agent donates electrons. A reducing agent means that it has electrons that it's going to donate to some other molecule. And when that other molecule receives those electrons, what does it become? It becomes reduced. All right, and when a reducing agent donates an electron to another molecule and that other molecule is reduced, what happens to the reducing agent? It becomes oxidized. All right, so that sounds really simple, but it's kind of confusing to think about. So just try to figure out, look at this a number of different times. All right, so an oxidizing agent accepts electrons. A really good example of that is oxygen. Okay, oxygen, or O2, is a kind of molecule that loves to accept electrons from someplace. And that's where this terminology came up from. So for instance, when we inhale air into our lungs, what are we absorbing? We are absorbing oxygen. And furthermore, what that oxygen is, we're absorbing what? A oxidizing agent, we're accepting, okay, an agent that can accept electrons. So we're inhaling electron acceptors because we need something to absorb those electrons that are being produced by our metabolism. Okay, so reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. You can't give an electron away unless one is accepted by another molecule. So they are coupled. And these statements right here, I hate, I should probably delete these from the slides. All right, but it's true. Sometimes they involve transfer of hydrogen ions instead of electrons. All right, and you could think of NAD and FAD as carriers for hydrogen ions. But actually, the best way that I found to visualize this is just always think in terms of electrons, not hydrogens. So here we have a couple large organic molecules. And you don't have to know what the names of these are. You have to know what the abbreviation is, okay? And NAD stands for nicotine amide dinucleotide. So there's going to be like two ATPs that are joined together. That's what that looks like. So that's NAD. This is an electron carrier. So what is a large organic molecule that carries reaction intermediates from one set of reactions to another set of reactions? It's called a coenzyme. So NAD is a perfect example of a coenzyme. And you have to have these in your diet. These are vitamins, right? And FAD, flavin adenine dinucleotide, very similar, but we just call that FAD, right? So these are also vitamins. And here's the last slide. I don't think this is an exam figure. You won't have to draw this out. But can you tell, is this a simple metal ion, or is this a large organic molecule? That we actually have both up here. These are two large organic molecules. So these are not cofactors, these are coenzymes. So here are important coenzymes. So let me stand over here because I can't zoom in. So this first one is NAD. So we have an adenine base right here, and this is what, a ribose sugar. You might be able to recognize some of this, and then you see the diphosphate, and we have another ribose right here. So this is nicotine amide dinucleotide. There are two nucleotides put together. And on this part of NAD, right at this location right here, we can add a couple protons and as well a couple electrons. And when we do, we have an NH2 group, and we have an additional two electrons right here, and that neutralizes this charge. So NAD is an ion. It's positively charged, but when it accepts electrons, the charge goes away. All right, it's no longer a cation. So what do we call that chemical process where NAD accepts electrons? What happens to NAD? It becomes oxidized or reduced? It's reduced. And when it's reduced, okay, it just adds this one hydrogen right here. Okay, it becomes NADH. NADH, but don't forget, the reason why it becomes reduced because it adds two electrons. So that's why I really want you to just think of NAD as an electron carrier. And then NAD, since it's a cofactor, what does a cofactor do? It carries something from one set of reactions to the other. What is it carrying to another set of reactions? These little electrons right there. Those, as a matter of fact, they're high-energy electrons that can be used to drive other kinds of metabolism inside the cell. Okay, so that's NAD. So NAD, when it becomes reduced, turns into NADH. So NAD with a plus two electrons, plus one hydrogen becomes NADH when it becomes reduced. Okay. becomes NADH. So we're going to talk about NADH, and NADH is a carrier of what? These high energy electrons that can be used for metabolism. As a matter of fact, they're high energy. They're going to be used to make a high energy molecule, your favorite high energy molecule, which is what? Okay, you can't say ice cream because that's food. I'm talking about a molecule. It is ATP, right? Okay, so these electrons are going to be used in an organelle inside your cell to make ATP. And you already know the name of that organelle. Take a guess which one that is. Mitochondria, right? Okay. All right, so here is another coenzyme, and this is FAD. And FAD can gain a couple electrons at this site right here and a couple protons. Right, FAD is not charged when it's oxidized. It's not an ion when it is reduced. All right, so it gains two electrons and two protons, so the charge doesn't change. But nonetheless, okay, when I look at this molecule right here, FAD plus two electrons, it's the same as NAD, plus two hydrogen ions produces FADH2, because we put those two hydrogens on there. And FADH2 is carrying what around inside your cells? What's the important thing to consider? I don't want you to think of those hydrogen atoms. I want you to think of these electrons right here. It's carrying these electrons around from one place to another. So it's almost sort of like a wire in a sense, except it's not continuous. These things just diffuse around in solution. All right, so this is kind of just a nice visual that shows that. So, for instance, if NAD is used to oxidize something, what happens to NAD when it oxidizes something? It becomes reduced because it accepts those electrons. Okay, so that terminology sometimes is tricky to think of. But they're always coupled reactions. All right, so that's it for this chapter. This is like an introduction to the next chapter that we're going to look at. Okay? You're just getting fun, having fun with this chapter, and we had to switch from it. Oh, well. Okay. So let's move on. But that's okay, because Chapter 5 really kind of picks up where we're leaving off. All right, so this is good. So cell respiration and metabolism. All right, so let's define what metabolism is. I don't think I have a slide that defines what metabolism is. Yeah, maybe I do have, I should have one in there. Okay. Metabolism, I guess I do have a slide on metabolism. Metabolism is just the sum of all chemical reactions taking place in your body. Every single reaction added up is going to produce your living state or your pathological state or whatever state we're all in. Okay? And there are two categories for metabolism. There is catabolism and anabolism. Maybe we've even talked about this stuff already. Catabolism breaks down large molecules into smaller ones, and in that process of doing that, like for instance, a hydrolysis reaction, that releases energy, that releases free energy. Anabolism, on the other hand, is where you take small molecules and put them together, and that requires energy. Right? So catabolic reactions are exothermic, anabolic reactions are... Did I say that right? Catabolic are exothermic, yeah, and anabolic are endothermic. So let's write two small molecules on the board. ADP plus inorganic phosphate. These are two small molecules, and we're going to make a big molecule out of it. What are we going to make? ATP, one bigger molecule. But in order for this to work, what do we have to put on this side over here? There's another entity that's not really a molecule, but it's something that we should be aware of, is what? Energy. That's right. And don't forget, energy is just that ability to do work. That energy has the ability to put these two molecules together to form ATP. And then where does that energy end up? Inside ATP. And then your cell, that energy floats around in your cell, and it can be used by different processes inside your cell. Okay, so don't forget that. That would be an example of an anabolic reaction. That can't happen all by itself. ADP plus inorganic phosphate can't automatically form ATP. It's got to get energy from someplace. And where it gets energy from is from a series of exergonic reactions, reactions that will be giving off energy. And we're going to see where that is. You know that's in the mitochondria already. Okay. All right, so here is a real important slide. I'm sure it's an exam figure. And so make sure you can just draw this out just from your mind, not just label, but go ahead and draw this out, because this is a nice basis for everything that we're going to be looking at. Okay, so I want you first off to put a couple numbers down here. And while we're talking about all this metabolism and cellular respiration, I don't want you to forget the big picture. And the big picture is, what's the purpose of cellular respiration? And we're going to look at all these reactions right here. Don't tell me right now, okay, if you know already. What's the purpose of cellular respiration? So we're going to learn different kinds, different metabolic pathways. But what's the whole purpose of cellular respiration? It's got to be important, otherwise we wouldn't study all of these different things. All right, so here we have an energy molecule, glucose, that we can have in our diet, and we absorb it from our digestive tract, and it gets absorbed into our blood, and it travels around through our circulatory system, and it's going to enter a cell. So this right here represents, this line right here represents a plasma membrane. So glucose somehow gets inside the cell, inside the cytoplasm. Now, there is an organ in your body that can also secrete glucose into the blood, because remember, your blood glucose should be maintained via homeostasis within normal ranges. And if you don't eat glucose in your diet, there is an organ that can release glucose into the blood. And that is, what organ is that? That's the liver. So even when you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose doesn't decrease if you have normal regulation of blood glucose. All right, so glucose in the plasma is going to be maintained fairly constant. Okay, and it gets inside the cell. And it's going to be used by the cell. The first process, and these are the numbers that I want you to put on your slide. The first process is glycolysis. So number one, glycolysis. I want you to write down. Okay. And glycolysis is going to proceed, and then it's going to give some intermediates to the Krebs cycle. That's number two. I want you to write down. And then things that are happening in the Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle or the citric acid cycle, those are the three names that I know for it. There might be some other names, but Krebs cycle, TCA cycle, citric acid cycle are all the same thing. I'll just try to refer to it as Krebs cycle. in here. All right. The third thing is electron transport. So glycolysis is one, Krebs is number two, electron transport is number three. So if I was going to highlight something, that's probably what I would have highlighted. Glycolysis, Krebs cycle, and electron transport. I don't know why these things are highlighted just yet. All right, so when this happens, okay, ATP is going to be produced by these three processes, glycolysis, Krebs cycle, and electron transport. Now, did you guys have a lab on this stuff already? Probably, right? Good. No? Not yet? All right, well, this lecture will make lab easier. Okay, so what we see, the input to this process right here is glucose. And if this process continues all the way through the Krebs cycle and electron transport, what is produced? CO2, carbon dioxide, and water. Can you remember what the backbone for glucose is? What is a typical formula for a saccharide or a monosaccharide or a simple sugar? Is what? Carbon and H2O, right? It's carbohydrate, that's a carbohydrate. So the carbons in glucose via this metabolism right here is completely converted into CO2. And that's what we breathe out of our bodies because that's a byproduct of metabolism. Actually, this is what we call cellular respiration right here. All right, so I see two kinds of cellular respiration. I see this light green area and the dark green area. Good? Yellow and green? Light and dark yellow. Not the colors I would have picked, but anyway. We see these two shaded areas right here. These are the two main kinds of respiration that we have inside the cell. This lighter one right here is what we call anaerobic respiration, and this darker area over here is what we call aerobic respiration. And the reason for that is that this process, which we call glycolysis, is not dependent on oxygen. You don't need oxygen to drive these reactions. But the Krebs cycle and electron transport require oxygen for them to work. So we call that aerobic respiration. And furthermore, aerobic respiration takes place in what organelle? Mitochondria. And anaerobic respiration takes place where? In the cytoplasm. You do not need an organelle to perform anaerobic respiration or glycolysis. So glycolysis is sort of a synonymous term to anaerobic respiration. So animals or cells that don't have organelles, like prokaryotic cells, like bacteria for instance, they don't have a mitochondria, they can only undergo glycolysis. They can't do Krebs cycle and electron transport. But I haven't told you why our bodies do these things yet. But maybe you're kind of getting a hint. Okay, so what the heck is glycolysis? All right, so this is the first reaction we're going to look at. Here is just a synopsis of what glycolysis is, but the name should automatically tell you a lot. What does lysis mean? Lysis, like hemolysis is, did we talk about hemolysis yet? Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, that's the breaking apart of a red blood cell, right? So lysis just means splitting apart, breaking up, blowing up. Right, so glycolysis just means taking a glucose molecule and snipping it in half. It's breaking it up into two pieces. That's what glycolysis does. Right, so it's a metabolic pathway by which one glucose is converted into two pyruvates. And if glucose is a six-carbon molecule and we snip it in half, how many carbons does pyruvate have? It's got three. So you've kind of figured out glycolysis already. So that's not too bad. Two pyruvates, so the input to glycolysis is glucose, and the end product is pyruvate, and in particular, 2-pyruvate. And that's just glucose chopped in half. But when we take a big molecule, like ATP, and chop it into smaller ones, what's released when that happens? Energy. And that energy with glycolysis can be used for something. We're going to see what it can be used for in just a second. Okay. So the overall reaction for glycolysis is that we have a glucose. We need some coenzymes. We need two NADs. we need some ADP and inorganic phosphate, and we let glycolysis run, we're going to end up with glucose cut in half, namely 2-pyruvate. These NAD are going to be, they're going to be what? Reduced or oxidized? They're going to be reduced because, remember, NAD carries electrons. Right? And actually, this should be what? NAD with a plus right there, NAD plus. Put a little plus because NAD is an ion. So we put 2 electrons on there and 1 proton. We're going to get a reduced form of NAD, and that is called NADH. We're going to get 2 NADHs. And, oh, look what else we get. Thank God. We get what? We get some ATP out of this reaction. How many? 2. Well, 2 is not really an astounding number, but it's better than 0. Okay, so we get 2 ATP via glycolysis. All right, so glycolysis is exergonic. That's like what? The big wheel, the big gear that I showed you with the last slide from the last chapter. And it produces 2 ATPs and 2 NADHs. Okay. Okay, when glucose gets inside the cell, it has to be phosphorylated. We call that activation. And it takes 2 ATP, all right, to phosphorylate each end of the glucose molecule. So when it gets in, cut in half, they both have a phosphate on them. So to start glycolysis, it's a little costly. It takes 2 ATP to do that. All right, and that phosphate, remember what kind of molecule inorganic phosphate is? It's a phosphate with an oxygen, and there's an OH, but that OH dissociates, so you're left with an ion right there. And the same over here. And the same over here. And then there's a double bond to an oxygen right here. Can that thing get through the cell membrane? This is actually going to be then bound to the glucose molecule right over here, so that goes away. But now you have this big phosphate with these negative charges on it. Can that get through a cell membrane? There's just no way because it's polar, right? It is hydrophilic, can't get through the membrane. So now glucose for sure is what? Trapped inside the cell. Most cells phosphorylate glucose so it can't run away because glucose is a very important energy molecule. Once the cell gets it, that cell is not going to want to share it with anybody else. All right, so that's what we mean. Phosphorylation traps the glucose inside the cell, and you should have a nice picture in your mind why that happens. Okay. All right, so here is a diagram of glycolysis. We plot free energy versus a reaction as it's proceeding. And what do we call a reaction that has many steps in it? And those steps are catalyzed by different enzymes. That's a metabolic pathway. So glycolysis has a number of steps. It's a metabolic pathway with various enzymes. And this semester, should I make you know what all the intermediates are and the names of the enzymes and all that stuff? Okay, I kind of flip back and forth, so this semester maybe I won't do that. Okay. But you got to get a sense of the overall thing of what's happening with this metabolic pathway. All right, so glucose comes into the cell. When we phosphorylate it, if we use some ATP to phosphorylate it, what happens to the energy content of glucose? Okay, so what did we have? We got 2 small molecules, and we make a bigger molecule out of it. So we got glucose with phosphate. It's a bigger molecule that requires what? Energy to make a bigger molecule. But now what's in that molecule since glucose is phosphorylated? It's that energy. It's incorporated that energy. So the free energy of glucose has been boosted up by expending some ATP. And then it gets boosted up once again, because it hydrolyzes another ATP. All right, so we've burned up 2 ATP. Now that glucose, since it's been doubly phosphorylated, that's the highest energy level, and then the metabolic reactions start to take place, that glucose starts to lose energy, and it can give up some electrons. It gives up electrons to NAD, what should be right here? NAD plus, right? NAD plus. It's going to accept 2 electrons twice. It's going to produce 2 NADHs, right? And but look at that big drop in energy. Where did this big drop in energy go to? Mostly it ended up where? In the production of NADH. So NADH is an energy carrier in the form of what? NADH is, what is energy? Well, how is NAD carrying energy? It's carrying physically some 2 electrons. Okay, it's carrying 2 electrons around, and there's energy in those electrons. And then there's another metabolic reaction, okay, that is coupled to phosphorylation of adenosine diphosphate. So here we have ADP plus inorganic phosphate as a result of this enzymatic reaction right here making 2 ATP. But in order to go from ADP and PI to ATP, what do we need? We need energy. Do you see some expenditure of energy on this diagram right here? Yeah, intermediate, okay, number 2, going to number 3 over here, right, releases energy, and that energy is coupled to the production of ATP inside the cell. Okay, so how many ATP did we spend so far to start this process? 2. And now we've got 2 back, so it's just kind of an even trade right now. But there is a last step in glycolysis, okay? And that last step will then phosphorylate 2 more ADPs into ATP. And when that happens, pyruvic acid is produced. So as these intermediates roll downhill in energy, it produces 4 ATP. You needed 2 to get it started out. So what's the net production of ATP by glycolysis? It is 2 ATP. For every 1 glucose. But there's something else that was produced that we don't want to lose. There's another high energy molecule. Well, there's energy in pyruvic acid still, but there's another energy molecule that was produced. It was a coenzyme, and that's NADH. There's still a lot of energy in NADH that can be used. Okay, so where does this process happen? In the cytoplasm. You don't need an organelle because all these enzymes are just floating around inside the cytoplasm. Okay. So that's what you have to remember for glycolysis. You get a net gain of 2 ATP and a net gain of 2 NADHs, and these NADHs are carrying high energy electrons around inside the cell. Okay. So here is really a more complete picture of what glycolysis looks like. All right, so how does glycolysis start? With glucose, right? And it's phosphorylated once, that produces glucose 6-phosphate. It's phosphorylated a second time, that produces, the glucose 6-phosphate just gets rearranged and converted into a fructose 6-phosphate, and then it's phosphorylated again into fructose 1,6-biphosphate. So these are just some chemical nomenclatures. And for this semester, this will not be an exam figure. So you don't have to remember all of these intermediates right here. But, you know, there's some time in your life where you actually might have to do that, depending on what program that you get into. And then this fructose 1,6-biphosphate, okay, gets split in half. So now, so fructose is a 6-carbon sugar. It gets split in half. So now you have 2 3-carbon sugars, right? Phosphoglyceraldehyde is a 3-carbon molecule, and you get 2 of them. And there's some electrons that molecule can donate to NAD+, reducing NAD+ into NADH. And then these other intermediates, you see these different steps right here, can be used to phosphorylate ADP and make ATP out of it, because there's enough free energy change with this reaction number 6 and reaction number 9 of glycolysis to phosphorylate ATP. All right, so it makes 4 after you spend 2 to get it going, and then you end up with pyruvic acid. So how many carbons are in pyruvic acid? Half the number that are in glucose, because we just split glucose in half, right? And we use that bond that we broke to make all of these ATP. Glycolysis. You got to know where that happens, the net production of ATP. And I had another thought, but I can't remember. I think that's good for glycolysis. Okay. So, what kind of respiration did we say that was? Aerobic or anaerobic respiration? anaerobic respiration. You never saw oxygen on any of those pathways right there. It just automatically happens. Okay. Well, let's go back to that first slide once again. Okay. I said that the Krebs cycle and electron transport require oxygen, but there might be some conditions where tissue doesn't have oxygen. All right, and your brain, you know, can't function very long without oxygen because it needs these mitochondria working to make ATP. But there are other kinds of tissues that you can have oxygen cut off, and they'll stay alive for a longer period of time because the ATP that's produced by glycolysis right here is sufficient to keep that tissue alive because it's not using a lot of ATP up. It's kind of in a rest state, like skeletal muscles, when you're not working them, don't require a lot of ATP. Well, okay, so in that case, when there is no oxygen, pyruvic acid cannot enter the Krebs cycle. That pyruvic acid can't even get inside the mitochondria. And so you have a buildup of pyruvic acid under the conditions where there is no oxygen. So what's going to happen to glycolysis if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cytoplasm of a cell? And you could invoke a little knowledge to explain why that happens. What's going to happen to glycolysis as pyruvic acid builds up? Remember their carbonic anhydrase reaction? We said that, according to Le Chatelier's principle, if products build up, it's going to force the reaction to go in the reverse direction. Okay, so under anaerobic conditions, this pyruvic acid is going to force glycolysis to run backwards. And what else is going to happen? Instead of making ATP, it could use up ATP. Now, you don't want a cell to use up ATP when it's having trouble making it in the first place, right? All right, so your body has developed another kind of metabolism to get rid of pyruvic acid under anaerobic conditions. And that's where we left off on this particular slide right here. So here is what pyruvic acid looks like. Remember, what kind of functional group is this right here? That's a carboxyl group. That's a carboxyl group, right? So it is an acid. So we call that pyruvic acid, but it also runs around with another name, and they're exactly the same. Pyruvic acid and pyruvate are exactly the same molecule. Pyruvate and pyruvic acid are the same chemical. Well, pyruvic acid can be converted into lactic acid. And so what happens? Well, we just take some high energy electrons from NADH and some protons, right? And we regenerate NADH plus and we produce lactic acid. So we added these two hydrogens right here with a couple electrons. So pyruvate is what? It's reduced to lactic acid, right? And lactic acid can leave the cell. So it doesn't build up inside the cell. And so pyruvic acid doesn't build up. What does that do? That's the end product of glycolysis. So if the end product doesn't build up, what happens to glycolysis? It keeps going. Yeah, so this is a way that your body has figured out how to keep glycolysis going, even though pyruvate really doesn't have any place to go. It gets shunted over to lactic acid right over here. So that keeps glycolysis working. And this enzyme right here is what we call lactate dehydrogenase. Okay, because if you go back the other way, you take these hydrogens off. Right, and what's another name for lactic acid? That would be lactate, just like pyruvic acid and pyruvate are the same molecule. All right, furthermore, this process right here is what we call anaerobic respiration, does not require oxygen, and sometimes we call that a fermentation process. And you're going to look at fermentation processes in lab if you didn't do that this week. Who had lab on? Well, all of you had lab. No, not your Friday group. What did you do in lab this week? You did the old respiration. Okay. All right. Well, you probably do the fermentation yeast next week. Okay. That's fun to talk about. I'll talk about it maybe after your test or something. All right. So this lactic acid is painful. It produces pain. So if you keep exercising and you have lactic acid in your body, you have pain inhibition. But this lactic acid also not only produces pain inhibition, but fatigue. Your muscles just won't be as strong anymore, even though you try to exercise them to the same degree. So that inhibits some other reactions. But lactic acid can leave the cell. Okay, so let's look at this diagram right here. So if pyruvic acid builds up, that's going to force what? The reverse of glycolysis. That's not going to produce ATP for the cell. But also, what else is building up inside the cell as glycolysis is proceeding in the forward direction? ATP is building up, but you don't have to worry about a buildup of ATP because if you're alive, what happens to ATP? It gets used up, right? So you don't have to worry about ATP inhibiting glycolysis. But there's another molecule that builds up, and that is NADH. And so if NADH builds up, what is that going to do to glycolysis? Is it going to keep it going in the forward direction, or it's going to make it go back the reverse direction again? When glycolysis goes in the reverse direction, you don't make ATP, right? Doesn't support life. So the other reaction that anaerobic respiration gets rid of, so glycolysis can proceed in the forward direction, is NADH, right? So that blocks Le Chatelier's principle for making glycolysis go backwards because you can get rid of NADH. Another way of looking at the importance of this reaction is in order for glycolysis to proceed in the forward direction, what molecule do you need? You need NAD+. And again, let's look at anaerobic respiration. What does it produce? NAD+, right? So for three important reasons, anaerobic respiration maintains glycolysis working for you, right? It gets rid of pyruvate because you don't want to inhibit glycolysis. It gets rid of NADH because that could inhibit glycolysis, but it also gives you NAD, which is what you need to have glycolysis working in the forward direction. So I think this right here probably is an exam figure right here. I'm pretty sure it is. Okay. You don't have to confirm that today. Okay. So, okay. The lactic acid. So this pathway only produces two ATPs per glucose. Red blood cells are real funny cells. They don't have a nucleus. And they don't have organelles. They don't have mitochondria either. So the only way that a red blood cell can make energy is through what? Anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration? Anaerobic, they can only make ATP through glycolysis and keeping glycolysis operating. The nice thing about a red blood cell is that they don't need a lot of energy to function because they're loaded up with hemoglobin and the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin is just a passive process. It doesn't require ATP. And it occurs in skeletal muscle in the heart when oxygen levels fall below a certain critical level. Like, for instance, when you contract a muscle, it turns into incredibly hard solid material. Okay? It's so hard and solid that it compresses the blood vessels, and blood can't get into the muscle when it's contracted. Okay? So that muscle is becoming ischemic when it's contracted. And what do you do with muscles all the time? You contract them and you produce ischemia. Oxygen can't get in there. But that muscle still needs ATP to stay alive. So under those conditions, right, the lactic acid pathway produces ATP to maintain the health of that muscle. Okay, so that's one of the purposes. But it produces pain if you overdo it. Okay, and the lactic acid pathway will maintain the health of those tissues under heavy exercise or some vascular blockage, as long as it's not complete. So that's one of the reasons why you experience a lot of pain when you're having a heart attack. When you cut off blood supply to the heart, lactic acid builds up in the heart. That's very painful. And of course, you want to reverse that vascular blockage as soon as you can, because it might go from ischemia to necrosis, and then you have a dead heart in that location. That's not good. Lactic acid, it will take care of itself after about 24 hours or so, okay, maybe a little bit faster. But what athletes do is you know, training is real good, because when you train, you increase a blood supply to a muscle, and when you train, you also stretch. So stretching helps perfusion, increase blood vessels to that muscle will increase perfusion. So anytime you can increase blood flow to a muscle, that's going to wash out the lactic acid. Right? So trained athletes can recover much more quickly from exercise than somebody that's not trained, because their muscles just have a better blood supply than that develops from training. Yeah. Yeah. So if you don't train and you exercise real severely or strenuously, then that lactic acid is going to build up. It's going to take a long time to wash away, and you'll feel miserable, okay, for 24 hours, maybe even 48 hours. But if you're a trained athlete, you can recover a lot more quickly because you have the blood vessels to take care of that. Yeah. So the way you can decrease the effects of lactic acid on a muscle is to exercise. It's one of the reasons why people hate this class. Because one way to help yourself the most is what? By proper exercise. Okay. Okay. Well, we know a little bit. I'm going to skip over these slides a little bit, but I'll come back to them. So what is, here we go. What is this process called when you go from glucose to pyruvic acid? Glycolysis, because you're breaking glucose in half, right? Okay. Well, there's another term for the reverse of glycolysis. All right, and you've got to be familiar with this. So glycolysis is what? Glycolysis is glucose going to pyruvate. But we can go the other way. We can go pyruvate, or maybe some other intermediates of glycolysis go back up to glucose. All right, so what do we call that? Yeah, it's a tongue twister. We're going to know four terms, and they're all going to sound very similar, but you got to be able to identify them verbally and say them and spell them. All right, and let me see if I can figure this one out. I can figure this out. This would be gluco, because what are we making? Glucose, right? Neo, what's neo mean? New, and it's genesis. Right, the building of new glucose in your body from these smaller intermediates, gluconeogenesis. All right, so gluconeogenesis is just the opposite of glycolysis. All right, so, and you can see it on this diagram. How can you see it on this diagram right here?
Really quick.
Yeah. I don't know. Let me keep talking.
All right.
Okay, I'll figure it out. No, that's something else. That's a different process. Okay, I'll describe that in just a second. All right, gluconeogenesis. On this slide right here, can you see that pathway? Tell me to look where on this slide. It's the dotted lines. Right, you see the reverse reaction taking place, right? You got the dotted lines versus the solid lines. I don't know, maybe they're different colors too, but the solid lines are glycolysis and the dotted lines are gluconeogenesis. Okay, making of new glucose. And this is important for maintaining blood glucose. So on this slide right here, I think we got all the important terms that we want to look at. All right. I did mention at one point in time, what is the basic building block of starch? Glucose, right? It's a huge polymer of glucose. So that's equal to what? Thousands of glucoses together. But we don't have starch in our bodies. Starch is from what plants make. What do animals make? Glycogen, right? So we've got glycogen right here. It's really what? The same thing. The branching pattern is a little bit. It's thousands of molecules of glucose all put together. So glycogen really is a storage form of glucose in your body. So if your body needs glucose in a hurry, it's going to go to glycogen and then snip off a couple, okay, and put it in the blood. All right, so that's kind of what this slide right here is showing us. So here we have a cell, and in particular, this cell right here is a liver cell. This is really the only kind of cell that will ever give up glucose, because every other cell phosphorylates glucose and will never let it go. Glycogen is a little bit more altruistic to the body. All right, so let's see how this happens. Okay, so when you're in a fasted state, no, when you're in a fed state, you have high blood glucose. Glucose will enter the cell, and all cells then will trap it by doing what? Phosphorylating it. And it uses up an ATP. So now instead of glucose, we have glucose phosphate, and it puts it on the sixth carbon. That's what that six right there means. That's probably not so important for you to know. But now we have a glucose with a phosphate on it. We call it glucose 6-phosphate. And this molecule here has a couple different fates in a liver cell. If you're really healthy and you're really in a fed state, your body is going to want to store this glucose. So how does it store the glucose? It converts it into glucose 6-phosphate, 1-phosphate. So the phosphate gets changed from the 6th carbon to the 1st carbon. And when that happens, then it can be polymerized or added to an existing glycogen molecule. So now the glycogen molecule has one extra glucose molecule to it. So we've taken the glucose and glomped it onto glycogen, making it a little bit bigger. So it's just storing the glucose. Right? Another possible fate, once glucose comes in the cell and it's phosphorylated, say you're running low on ATP. What will happen then? Well, if you're running low on ATP, your cell doesn't want to store glucose. It wants to metabolize it. And the way you do that is by giving it to glycolysis. And this is just one of the first steps of glycolysis when it's converted into fructose. All right, so glucose can be used to make ATP versus glycolysis right here. All right, so these lower arrows right here represent glycolysis. But this arrow, when glucose is used to make glycogen, that's what we call glycogenesis. So glycogenesis is different than gluconeogenesis. All right, so that's glycogenesis. All right, so now let's just say that you're in a fasted state. You're not absorbing glucose from your digestive tract, so your blood glucose starts to go down. What does your body want to do? It wants to maintain it, right? It wants to move it back up. And where can it get glucose from? Glycogen. In particular, glycogen in the liver. So there is another enzyme that gets activated. That's enzyme number 2 over here. What do we call an enzyme that phosphorylates something? That's a kinase enzyme, right? So there is a glycogen kinase that phosphorylates, and then that one glucose molecule comes off. It produces glucose 6-phosphate. Okay, and the liver is the only kind of tissue that has a glucose 6-phosphatase, is an enzyme that will take this phosphate off, and it becomes regular glucose, and that regular glucose can end up in the blood maintaining blood glucose levels. Right, so phosphatase takes that phosphate off that maintains a blood glucose level. So the production of glycogen from glucose is gluconeogenesis. The production of glucose from glycogen, right, which is the reverse of glycogenesis, is glycogenolysis. Right, so again, lysis, when you're breaking a molecule down, that's lysis. Glycolysis is the breaking down of glucose. Glycogenolysis is the breaking down of glycogen. All right, once you say it a few times, it won't be too bad. But you gotta be able to say that. So these are 3 of the 4 terms that I promised you that you'll have to know about. Right? Glycolysis is what? The breaking down of glucose into pyruvate. What's the reverse? And you might want to draw the reverse. Right? The reverse is gluconeogenesis. And if we take glucose and make glycogen out of it, that is glycogenesis, because that glyco refers to what? Glycogen. And then the breaking down of glycogen to put glucose in the blood is what? Glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis, we say. So those are the four terms. So this is a pretty good exam figure right here. Okay, as I modified it, I could put another little arrow going what? What intermediate would we put down right here at the bottom of glycolysis? Pyruvate. Right, so if we put pyruvate there with an up arrow, right, that would be gluconeogenesis. So a little modification of that slide, you would see all of those terms. So by balancing out glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, glycogenesis, and glycogenolysis, that's a way that your body maintains blood glucose. Okay. So, for instance, over the weekend, make sure you can define these terms for yourself. We've got glycolysis, gluconeogenesis. Oh, and I'll erase the key. Right here. Gluconeogenesis. What else do we have? We have glycogenesis. And we have glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. So these four processes that are involved in glucose metabolism. Did I write it correctly? Spell it correctly? Okay. Now I've had some students that were never able to figure that out. Okay, and I didn't know if they didn't know how to spell, but on the test, you know, I'll put glycogenolysis and you'll have to know which way it goes and don't get it confused with gluconeogenesis or those other terms. Okay? So, if you need reading glasses, these words are spelled almost the same. So if you need reading glasses, make sure you bring them to the test to see how you spell these words, because you'll just get lost otherwise. All right, so let's look at, where did we end off? Okay, so we ended off here. Glycogenesis versus glycogenolysis. All right, for osmotic reasons, the cell can't store many free glucoses. Because what happens if we're trying to store glucose inside of a cell? Here we have a cell. What do we mean by osmotic reasons? Here we have a cell, and it's got what? 0.9% NaCl. And now we're going to start putting in a bunch of glucose, right? Millions of glucoses in here. What else is going to happen to the cell when we start putting solute? Maybe we're going to store a million glucose molecules in here. What else is going to happen? The concentration of solute is going to go way up, so it's going to draw water into the cell, and it's going to burst that cell. So the cells can't store free glucose. But what can a cell do? It can connect all of these glucoses together. So it doesn't look like all of these different particles, it just looks like one particle. It doesn't change the osmotic pressure of the cell. That's what that part of the slide is supposed to say. Okay. So it's handy for water balance inside the cell. All right, so skeletal muscle and liver store lots of glycogen. Skeletal muscle never gives it up to the blood because it doesn't have a phosphatase. The liver has the phosphatase, so it can actually donate glucose to the blood. All right, so instead of glucose, glucogen is converted into glycogen by glycogenesis. And, all right, when you're in a fasted state, glycogen is used as a reservoir for glucose. So that process, breaking glucose off of glycogen, is called glycogenolysis. That clips glucose out of glycogen, and then that glucose can end up in the blood to maintain your blood glucose levels. Okay. All right, so here you have some definitions of glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis. Those you have to become familiar with. These other terms are interesting, but you could probably figure them out. Like lipogenesis is what? The making of lipid. And lipolysis is what? Breaking down of lipid. And this process, I don't know how much we're going to talk about this. I need to get some other slides. Ketogenesis, when when you don't have carbohydrates in your body, then you don't have carbohydrates like glucose to make ATP. So your body goes to fats to make ATP. But even without some carbohydrates in your body, you can't make ATP from lipids, and a byproduct of that metabolism is ketogenesis. So when you're breaking down lipids, but you still can't get energy out of them, that produces ketones, so we call that ketogenesis. All right, I'll just talk a little bit more about that sometime later on in the class. All right, so here is a Cori cycle that incorporates some of these terms that we were talking about. Okay. So here we have a skeletal muscle cell, and it takes glucose up from the blood, and it doesn't want to lose that glucose. So what does it do? It phosphorylates it right away. What's the name of an enzyme that will phosphorylate it? That's a kinase. All right, so now this glucose is trapped inside the cell, can't get through the cell membrane. It's going to go and be converted into pyruvate via what kind of pathway? Glucose to pyruvate is? Glycolysis, right? All right, and under anaerobic conditions, that produces lactic acid and only 2 ATP, for instance. But if this cell is fine with its ATP, the amount of ATP it has, this glucose can be converted into glycogen. What's the name of this process, number 9? Glycogenesis. See, I even have to stop and think for half a second. Glycogenesis. All right, so when this muscle is at rest, right, it's storing glucose in the form of glycogen via glycogenesis. But when that muscle starts exercising, it wants to get at that glucose that's in glycogen during exercise. Glycogen gets broken down to glucose 6-phosphate. What do we call this process? Number 1. Glycogenolysis. Not glycolysis, but glycogenolysis. All right. Now, when someone asked me about lactic acid. Now, here's a little bit more of the truth about lactic acid. Okay, pyruvate can't leave the cell, but lactic acid can. It washes out, so if you have blood going to the muscle after exercise, it can be washed out of the cell, and the pain associated with that exercise is going to decrease, and the more you exercise, the better your body is at getting rid of lactic acid. But lactic acid, in terms of energy, is very similar to pyruvic acid. So it's not something you want to throw away, because it has a lot of potential to make ATP for you. So lactic acid goes in the blood, and guess who picks it up? The liver takes it up, and it converts it back to pyruvic acid, which then gets converted back to glucose. What do we call this pathway, where lactic acid gets converted back all the way up to glucose? That is gluconeogenesis. That's done in the liver. And then the liver can do a couple things. It can put it back in the blood as glucose, or it can be used to make glycogen. So what's the process of going from glucose 6-phosphate to glycogen? That is glycogenesis, right? Or the liver can break glycogen down into glucose. What's that? Glycogenolysis, right? All right, so we talked about all these different terms. So this right here is what we call the Cori cycle. And the liver is not a muscle, right? It never contracts. It really never runs out of oxygen unless you're almost dead. So there's plenty of oxygen inside the liver to keep gluconeogenesis working. So what a skeletal muscle does, it defers the burden of this lactic acid to the liver, which has plenty of oxygen to convert it back to glucose, and then that can be given back to a muscle cell to generate some ATP. At least what? How many ATP can this muscle cell produce from this one glucose via glycolysis? Just 2. All right, so the liver can help out when the muscle is operating anaerobically. And that's what we call the Cori cycle. Okay. The next topic. So we're done with anaerobic respiration. Okay, and the next topic is aerobic respiration. And you can't forget what the whole purpose of respiration is inside the cell. You don't tell me right now, okay, but sometime I want you to be able to tell me what is the purpose of this glycolysis, anaerobic respiration. You see there's a lot of different pieces, and you should appreciate why that's happening inside your cells. Okay, aerobic respiration. First off, pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria, but it has to have a reason for going in, or it has to have a passport for entering the mitochondria. It can only enter the mitochondria under certain conditions. And that was really on the first slide. What conditions can pyruvic acid enter a mitochondria and leave the cytoplasm? When there is oxygen present. When there's oxygen present, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria. But when there's no oxygen, what happens to pyruvate? Gets converted to lactate, and that lactate leaves the cell under anaerobic conditions. But when there is oxygen present, pyruvate enters the mitochondria. And here is a preparation reaction. So maybe on this slide you should say preparation for the Krebs cycle. So this is a preparation reaction. So this is pyruvic acid. And pyruvic acid will combine with another coenzyme right here. This is a large organic molecule. We call this coenzyme A. And it's probably called coenzyme A, maybe for a couple reasons, because when it binds to pyruvate, it chops off a CO2 from this carboxyl group, right? And you're left with this two-carbon fragment right here. That two-carbon fragment is called an acetyl group. Acetyl group. So this is an acetyl group bound to coenzyme A, so this intermediate is called acetyl coenzyme A, and maybe that's why we call this A, coenzyme A, because of this acetyl group. But you know what? It might have been the first coenzyme that was discovered. So you could say coenzyme number one or coenzyme A because it's the first one. Okay, so I'm not sure how it got named, but both of those reasons probably work for me. All right, so here is the production of CO2. So here is the first step whereby we are actually producing this byproduct of respiration, namely CO2. Is with this preparation reaction. But what else happens? What should this NAD really be? It should be an NAD plus right here. All right, so NAD becomes reduced. It produces NADH in this reaction. And we want to just keep this in the back of our minds, this NADH, until maybe, you're going to have to wait maybe the whole weekend. I don't know if I'll have time to talk about it today. But don't forget about NADH. What other reaction is producing NADH for us? Glycolysis is producing NADH. We're going to do something with NADH in a little bit. All right, so now we have acetyl coenzyme A and this byproduct, CO2, but we still have two carbons left. We still have this nice covalent bond right here. This covalent bond is what, a strong bond or a weak bond? It's a strong bond. There's a lot of energy associated with it, and your body uses that to make ATP. Okay, so the next slide. Okay, so here's glycolysis producing pyruvic acid, which is that three-carbon fragment. Under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria, and as a result, as long as you have coenzyme A, that's going to decarboxylate it, produce one CO2, and you're going to end up with acetyl coenzyme A, and don't forget you also get an NADH right here. Now, acetyl coenzyme A can enter that on the first slide that I had you mark with a number 2, the second set of metabolic reactions, and that's the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle starts when we have a molecule that has 4 carbon atoms on it, and we're going to add 2, what are we going to end up with? We're going to end up back with 6 again. Okay, so I don't think I'm going to ask you to know the names of these intermediates right here, but oxaloacetic acid is that 4-carbon fragment, and when acetyl-CoA donates that acetyl group, it becomes citric acid. It has 6 carbons on it, right? And guess what happens to coenzyme A as a result? It recycles. It's a coenzyme, right? So just like any kind of enzyme, it doesn't get used up. It's a coenzyme because what is it carrying around with it? It's carrying this acetyl group, that 2-carbon fragment. So it's really a nice coenzyme. doesn't get used up. It's carrying that acetyl group. It's donating that acetyl group to the Krebs cycle. And as these molecules flip from one kind of molecule to another, they become decarboxylated. So the Krebs cycle produces the final carbon dioxides that were in that glucose molecule that you breathe out of your body. So what are the, so CO2 is produced by what organelle inside your body? The mitochondria. One CO2 is produced by the preparation reaction, but two are produced by the Krebs cycle. And as a result of the Krebs cycle, look, oxaloacetic acid is regenerated again. So it's ready to what? Accept another acetyl group from acetyl coenzyme A. But as these intermediates are flipping around over here, something else is being produced. So let's see what else is being produced. Okay, the Krebs cycle produces a guanosine triphosphate. I don't think I have all the inter... Oh yeah, here's the full Krebs cycle right here. And, okay, so glycolysis, we're not learning the intermediates, but for Krebs, should we learn all the intermediates right here this semester? No, maybe just the synopsis of the Krebs cycle, okay? All right, so let's go back and look at the synopsis. Through that one round of the Krebs cycle, it produces one guanosine triphosphate that has the exact same energy content as ATP. Right, so a GTP can be used to phosphorylate ADP to make an ATP out of it. That's handy. One round of the Krebs cycle produces three NADHs. What is NADH carrying? High energy electrons. It's carrying high energy electrons. And one round of the Krebs cycle is going to produce one FADH. That's carrying high energy electrons as well. These are both what? Coenzymes that are carrying electrons. So these are the reduced forms of NAD plus and FAD. These are the reduced forms of NAD plus and FAD. Oh, well, thank goodness here it says NADH and FADH2 carry electrons to the third set of reactions that I had you label on your first diagram, which is what? The electron transport chain. That's where those electrons from NADH and FADH2 go to. Electron transport. All right, so here is the whole Krebs cycle. So the input is what? Acetyl-CoA. And as all these intermediates form, it produces one, two, three NADHs at these different steps, one FADH2, and we're going to use these electrons starting next week. And between alpha ketoglutarate and succinic acid, there is an enzyme step that has enough energy associated with it to where it can phosphorylate guanosine diphosphate and make it into a guanosine triphosphate, and this GTP can be used to, or it can be used to energize the production of one ATP. Now, what else is happening before we go? We see some energy molecules being produced, namely ATP, NADHs and FADH2 over here, but what else is happening? You start with a four-carbon molecule, and you end up with a four-carbon molecule, but we've added this two-carbon, so what happens to these extra two carbons right here? They're actually lost as CO2, right? So the Krebs cycle produces that CO2 that we breathe out of our bodies, okay? Now, what you don't see right here is the necessity for oxygen for, in order to maintain the cycle. You just see the production of CO2. Where does that happen? Happens, here's one step, here's the second step. So now the carbons in glucose are completely converted into CO2. And you breathe that out of your body. So you eat the solid molecule of glucose and you breathe its byproducts out as CO2. And in the process, you're making energy. Okay. You have to know this figure right here? This one here? No, I don't think that's an exam figure. Yeah, double check. LE.